It is Wednesday, June 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Democrats advance in the California primary election. Iran prepares to resume nuclear enrichment, and we hear how advances in exoskeleton technology could help some people walk again. It's all ahead. Democrats in California, the most populous U.S. state, appear to be on track after Tuesday's primary elections to win slots in November's general election ballots in key congressional districts. Democrats are looking to California, where opposition to President Donald Trump is pronounced, to provide some of the 23-seat pickup they would need to wrest control of the House from Republicans. Republican businessman John Cox finished second in the 27-candidate field, but he starts as a heavy underdog in the race for governor against the frontrunner in Tuesday's balloting, Democratic Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, a former mayor of San Francisco. Bill Whalen is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and a former speechwriter for former Governor Pete Wilson. I asked him whether Cox and Newsom were expected to be the top vote-getters in the governor's race.
They were the two expected vote-getters as of the last couple of weeks, but about a month ago, it was looking more like a race perhaps between Newsom and Antonio Villaraigosa, Democrat and former mayor of Los Angeles. But the Villaraigosa campaign never quite took off, and Cox's campaign did take off, thanks in no small part to President Trump, who endorsed him about a week ago.
California is perceived as a very Democratic state. How did Trump's tweeting or support for Cox really help him?
It helped in this regard. Even though California has switched to what's called an open primary system, where all candidates appear on the same ballot at the same time, 27 people running for governor on Tuesday night in California, it's still in some regards a Democratic primary and Republican primary. Gavin Newsom finished first with about 33% of the vote. John Cox was second with about 26%. But if you look at the overall numbers, Democrats made up about 61% of the primary vote, and Republicans only about 38% of the primary vote. So Cox won 26% of 38% of the Republican vote, if you want to look at it that way. So in that regard, having President Trump's endorsement was key because it solidified the Republican vote behind him. That's the good news for John Cox. Trump was important in getting him over the top in the primary. But the question is going to be, where does Cox go from here come November? There have been 8 gubernatorial votes in California going back to 1998. 2 of those votes involved Arnold Schwarzenegger, the recall in 2003, and then his reelection in 2006. 4 other times, a Republican was on the ballot. In each case, the Republican candidate failed to crack 43% of the statewide votes. That's the challenge for John Cox from here going forward. He has 5 months to figure out how to get to 43% at a minimum, and then how to tack on about an extra 5% from that, which he will need to win the election.
What about the Latino vote? I mean, I believe the Latino, it's the largest ethnic group in California now.
Latinos make up about 40% of the California population, but only about 25% of the California voting population. They are underrepresented. They don't register in ample numbers, if you will. And every 2 to 4 years in California, you hear a phrase, the sleeping giant of California politics, which is a referral to the Latino population. But, and this is the head scratcher, turnout last night in California was light. It was only about 21.6%, which is obviously not good. Latino turnout was especially bad. I've yet to see a figure on it, but it just didn't pan out. And that's reflected in the numbers for Antonio Villaraigosa. Here is somebody who was in 2005 elected as the first Latino mayor of Los Angeles in over a century, somebody who went out of his way to court Latinos in this election. And last night he got only about 12% of the vote. Latinos just simply didn't turn out for him. They didn't turn out in larger numbers altogether. So that's something both Republicans and Democrats are trying to figure out this hour, just where is Latino vote and why is it not motivated?
And looking at the House seats, I know that a number of Democrats are hoping to pick up some additional congressional seats there. How does that look overall?
Both parties complain about the open party system, both bitterly opposed it when it was put up for a vote in California in 2010 in the form of Proposition 14. both don't like the system, but both actually could walk away with something to smile about, if you will. Democrats feared being shut out of a couple of congressional races. Under our system, the top two finishers advance to the general election regardless of party affiliation. So it could be a Republican and Democrat, or two Democrats or two Republicans. The Democrats feared being shut out in two districts in Southern California. Democrats will be on the ballot in these and other key races. What's good news for Republicans coming out of it last night is you look at several other districts. There are seven Republican districts that the Democrats have targeted in this particular cycle. Republicans hold only 14 seats overall statewide. But in some of these districts, Republicans got 52% to 57% of the primary vote. That bodes pretty well if Democrats are trying to make this a referendum on the incumbent.
Bill Whalen, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. House Speaker Paul Ryan rejects President Donald Trump's claim that the FBI spied on his 2016 campaign. European nations seek exemption from U.S. sanctions on Iran. Singapore's foreign minister will visit North Korea ahead of the summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump. And China blasts the United States for flying B-52 bombers near disputed islands in the South China Sea. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Some 4.5 billion years ago, our sun was born among a cluster of thousands of other stars. Now, Australian and European astronomers are trying to find our sun's long-lost solar siblings, which are scattered throughout our galaxy. To do so, the scientists examine the chemical profiles of 350,000 stars in the Milky Way as though they were mapping each star's DNA. The mapping is part of an ongoing survey called GALA, or Galactic Archaeology with Hermes, which began in 2013. Hermes is the name of the spectrograph that's being used to determine the star's chemical makeup. Sarah Martell from the University of New South Wales, Sydney, who leads the GALA survey observations, explains that when they are found, every star in the sun's original birth cluster will have the very same chemical composition as our own sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, 1 in 10 people globally need treatment for mental health issues during their lifetime. We'll hear more about that. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, on his way to the Group of Seven annual meeting in Canada Friday and Saturday, will hold another White House summit with President Donald Trump Thursday, ahead of Trump's expected meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un next week in Singapore. Mr. Abe is not only a strong advocate for the complete denuclearization of Pyongyang and the maximum pressure campaign, but also alarmed at talk about a possible U.S. troop withdrawal from South Korea and the abductee issue. Jeff Kingston is an Asia Studies professor at Temple University in Tokyo. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty there's a great deal of anxiety in Japan about Trump's intentions.
I think that Prime Minister Abe's signature policy has been the abduction issue, in which in the 1980s, several dozen Japanese were abducted and brought to North Korea, and the fate of them is unknown. So he has made it his priority during this whole process leading up to the Trump summit with Kim to emphasize the necessity for Pyongyang to come clean about the abductees. And, you know, when he visited Trump before, you know, he got Trump to say, yes, of course, he'll bring it up and that it is a priority. However, Trump creates anxieties in the Abe cabinet because he keeps changing his stance on critical issues. And Abe has made a point of trying to cozy up to Trump. And he was one of the first leaders to visit him even before he became president after the elections. But his high regard for Trump has not been reciprocated. So Trump pulled the plug on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, recently slapped tariffs on Japanese steel and aluminum products, talked about putting tariffs on car and car parts. So across the board, Trump has pulled the rug out from underneath Abe on several issues. And just this past week, there was discord between Seoul and Washington on one hand and Tokyo regarding the policy of maximum pressure. And so Seoul and Washington believe that there is an opportunity to explore the possibilities that may be open with the summit with Kim. And the Abe camp has basically indicated that they hope that these talks fail. And they want Trump to be aware that North Korea has a checkered track record of broken promises and pledges. And he wants to ensure that Trump does not take Kim's assurances that the abductee issue has been resolved. From Tokyo's perspective, that's not the case.
Is there also a concern that the president is interested in reducing the possibility of a nuclear strike on U.S. cities, but that would leave North Korea capable of still hitting Japanese cities?
Yes, absolutely. America First looks a rather unsettling policy from Tokyo's perspective, because here we are very close to North Korea. And so, you know, Trump's main concern, of course, is to protect Americans and American soil. And so they're worried that this process of denuclearization is going to be drawn out, and that in that process, North Korea will be recognized as a de facto nuclear power, and maybe it will give up some of its capacity but retain other missiles and other weapon systems that threaten Tokyo.
That's Jeff Kingston of Temple University in Tokyo. Iran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency it will resume testing of a new generation of nuclear centrifuges that the head of its nuclear energy agency, Ali Akbar Salehi, says equipment testing would resume as of Wednesday. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Ali Akbar Salehi said Tehran would remain within the framework of the nuclear deal reached with the five permanent members of the United Nations plus Germany. Salehi added that the accord allowed Iran to test a new generation of nuclear centrifuges and that his country's nuclear program is intended for peaceful civilian purposes. He says Ayatollah Ali Khamenei issued a religious edict some years ago that banned nuclear weapons. Khamenei told a group of visitors Monday he had issued orders for the country's atomic energy organization to increase its enrichment capacity. Khamenei says he asked the Nuclear Energy Agency to immediately begin the necessary preparations to increase the capacity of enrichment to 190,000 centrifuges provisionally in accordance with the deal. President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the 2015 nuclear accord last month. Britain, France, and Germany have been attempting to salvage the deal that Trump has described as horrible and one-sided. Former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr tells VOA he thinks Khamenei's decision to resume nuclear enrichment capacity is not a well-thought-out move, and that it is having negative consequences on regional interests.
La position prise par Khamenei.
Bani Sadr said Khamenei's decision plays into the hands of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, strengthening Netanyahu's charge that Iran represents a threat to Israel and that Tehran must evacuate its forces from Syria, as requested by the U.S.-Israeli-Saudi axis. Bani Sadr added the Ayatollah's statement that Israel will be eradicated from the face of the earth negatively influences world public opinion against Tehran. Khatar Abu Diab is a political science professor at the University of Paris. He tells VOA Khamenei's decision was aimed at pressuring Europe and indirectly negotiating with the United States.
C'est un moyen de pression de plus.
He says Iran's decision to increase its nuclear enrichment capacity is yet another attempt at pressuring or blackmailing Europe into gaining concessions from Washington. He says while France's foreign minister spoke of red lines that Iran must not cross, Paris, Berlin, and London have requested that Washington exempt them from new economic sanctions President Trump has imposed on Iran. Abu Diab argues that despite Iran's bluster, he suspects it fears any eventual reaction or backlash from Washington. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The World Health Organization reports 1 in 10 people will need to be treated for a mental health condition at some point during their lifetime, but chances of their getting the care they need is very low. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of the WHO's Mental Health Atlas 2017.
Unsurprisingly, data from 177 countries find rich countries are doing better in caring for the mentally ill than our poor countries. But the more significant finding is most countries are not doing enough and not spending enough to tackle this huge and growing problem. The WHO Mental Health Atlas 2017 reveals a global shortage of trained mental health workers, especially in poor countries, which have an estimated 2 health workers per 100,000 people, compared with more than 70 workers in rich countries. It says the economic burden resulting from mental illness is huge. For example, a recent study shows the economic loss due to common mental disorders such as depression and anxiety can be as high as $1 trillion a year. WHO Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Program Manager Tarun Dua says people with mental illness suffer from stigma and are victims of human rights violations because of their condition. She tells VOA too much emphasis is placed on institutional care for the mentally ill. She says governments must put their effort and money into strengthening community-based services.
And for 2 reasons. 1, as you mentioned, the services in community are more cost-effective. 2, this is what people with mental health conditions want. Services that are closer to them rather than services that are in institutions. Third, the services when they are provided in institutions, we know that the human rights can be violated.
The World Health Organization reports governments in low- and middle-income countries spend less than $1 per capita on mental health compared with high-income countries that spend more than $80. It says most of this money goes to mental hospitals, which serve a small proportion of those in need of care. WHO says investing in mental health makes good health and good economic sense. For example, it notes every dollar invested in treating depression and anxiety leads to a return of $4 in better health and productivity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and 2 advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. Every year, more than 15 million people worldwide suffer injuries and illnesses that leave them unable to walk, according to the World Health Organization. But new technological advances in physical therapy could help some of them walk again. Among the most promising is the use of robotic exoskeletons. As Erica Celeste reports, scientists at the University of Notre Dame are leading the way with their work on wearable robots that allow patients to regain some or all of their mobility.
17-year-old Lindsay Stofen loved to play tennis, softball, and run until last October when a rare disorder paralyzed her legs and left her in a wheelchair. But in late April, after becoming an inpatient at Marion Joy Rehabilitation Hospital in Chicago, the teen climbed into a specially designed exoskeleton, which supported her body and moved her legs.
I was like, dang, I'm going to be a robot. And then I was like scared at first. I was like, am I going to like it? Is it going to be okay? And then once I got into it, I loved it.
Lauren Belarzik, Lindsay's physical therapist, says the exo-robots help to accelerate the rehabilitation process.
For someone who takes a lot of energy to walk only a few feet, exo can get them up, can get them moving. It can supplement their movements. It can get that reciprocal pattern, encourage the correct motor planning.
Besides speeding up recovery times, these robotic skeletons are especially helpful for those with paralysis from spinal cord injuries and strokes. Using the machine can help some patients rewire their brains to use secondary muscles, so they can eventually walk again without the device. But Patrick Wenzing, assistant professor at the University of Notre Dame, says exoskeletons have one big drawback.
While existing exoskeletons are very powerful, right now they don't understand what the user wants to do. So in order to transition between activities in daily life, you often have to press a button interface to tell the exoskeleton, I would like to stand up now.
Wenzing and his team are collaborating with ExoBionics, a leading developer of wearable robots, to create a machine that can understand what its user wants to do without implanted sensors and complicated control panels. The new 3-year project, funded by the National Science Foundation's Robotic Initiative, hopes to achieve a more fluid, intuitive system. Taylor Gambin has spent the last year analyzing data from exo users and comparing them to models of everyday walking.
So what we're seeing is that slow walking in general, whether in the exoskeleton or just the human, is much different from walking at a speed that you would choose naturally.
Later this year, the team will travel to ExoBionics' California headquarters, where they will work directly with exoskeletons to design a program that interacts with users of various disabilities, so that more people like Lindsay Stofing can get back on their feet again. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month in the United States. In June 2005, the House of Representatives unanimously adopted a resolution recognizing the significance of Caribbean people and their descendants in the history and culture of the United States. On February 14, 2006, the resolution passed the Senate. The proclamation was first issued by President George W. Bush on June 6, 2006. During the Caribbean American Heritage Month, we honor America's long-shared history with our neighbors in the Caribbean and celebrate the Caribbean Americans who have enriched our nation, said President Donald Trump in a proclamation issued on May 31st. Caribbean Americans embody the American spirit, with their talents and hard work contributing greatly to America's economy, he said. They protect our citizens as law enforcement officers, serve our communities as public officials, and mentor our country's young people as educators. Through their tremendous athleticism and determination, they have brought pride to the hearts of the American people as members of numerous U.S. Olympic teams. Their leadership and resolve have made incredible contributions to our society. As trailblazers, Americans with Caribbean roots have sewn their own unique thread into the fabric of our nation, the president noted. Dr. William Thornton, a native of the British Virgin Islands, designed the United States Capitol and is generally considered the first architect of the Capitol. Jean-Baptiste du Sable, the first permanent resident of Chicago, was born in Haiti. Widely recognized as the founder of Chicago, his prosperous trade settlement has become one of the most iconic cities in the world. This month, said President Trump, we acknowledge the numerous contributions of Caribbean Americans to our nation, including those of the more than 4 million Caribbean Americans who live in the United States today. We are also deeply grateful to the many Caribbean Americans who have served or are currently serving our country as members of our armed forces. The United States is proud to recognize the achievements of Caribbean Americans and contributions they have made and continue to make to the United States and to the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.